Discovering the Past, New Mexico, July 12 to August 5, 2011. New Mexico in July? Are you nuts? Kind of seemed that way, but Ron had a hankering to attend his high school reunion. Not a reunion, but a celebration of everyone's 65th birthday. Did he know anyone? Not a soul, except a couple of people from the internet email, and they didn't come. But that was the reason we left town on the 12th of July. I'd never been to New Mexico, and Ron wanted to show me his old stomping grounds. It's a 3-day trip to the middle of New Mexico, Seattle to Pendleton, Oregon, over the Blue Mountains into Boise, slice across Idaho to Salt Lake City, and then due south to New Mexico through Tony Hillerman's Indian Country. Destination was the resort town of Ruidoso in the hills of Lincoln County, where the Artesia High School alums planned to gather for a weekend of fun and food. Tony Hillerman Country, the northwest corner of New Mexico and the northeast corner of Arizona, where the various Indian reservations jostle with each other. But the biggest is the Navajo Nation. Alongside and within it live the Hopis and the Utes. Spread across the northern part of the state are the 19 pueblos, each its own tribe. And then, further south, are the Apaches. Casinos abound on the various reservations, and I think they are enjoying some prosperity. A number of tented casinos. One of the landmarks that Tony mentions in his book is Shiprock. That's actually a town, but it's also a mountain with several spires. Driving along, it looked like a dark ship cruising on a sea of sand. Incredible to watch. Sadly, Tony Hillerman died 2 years ago. In Albuquerque, there are several areas that carry his name. We listened to two of Hillerman's books as we drove, The Dance Hall of the Dead and The Listening Woman, both of them Lieutenant Joe Leaport. To make such a trip, I burned 60 CDs of recorded books to listen to. For the first time ever, we had a car that had a CD player, but unfortunately, not an MP3 player. Well, maybe the next car. Ron enjoyed listening so much to the books on tape that he didn't get tired. We didn't even switch off once. We took in the sights as we went, like Arches National Park in Utah, where the hillside of sandstone is carved into fantastic shapes and arches. We drove along the edge of the White Sands Proving Grounds, where the first atomic bomb was tested at Trinity. We stopped at a rock shop where Ron bought a tiny sample of the melted sand from the blast, called Trentonite. It's only slightly more radioactive than the normal background. I bought samples of the local minerals like fluorite, linerite, smoky quartz, and brochonite. Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. The reunion was a blast. There were around 50 alums out of a class of 200 who graduated, and a group of them took Ron and me under their wings. Ron was in Artesia only for his junior year, but that's the high school he remembers fondly. When he told them he'd be attending, I'm sure it unleashed a flurry of searching in yearbooks. Who was this guy and what did he look like? It was interesting hanging out with a group of people who are all the same age and sharing the same experiences and times. The alums had a dinner in a restaurant, Cattleman's, on Friday night, piled into a chartered bus to a cattle ranch for a barbecue on Saturday evening, and the breakfast at the Apache Station Casino. Hey, a barbecue to me means hamburgers and hot dogs. So I made sure we didn't have that for lunch. We were stunned to be presented with a porterhouse steak that had to be 8 inches across and must have weighed 18 to 20 ounces. Seasoned with Canadian seasoning, Montreal seasoning, garlic, salt, and black pepper, it was luscious and definitely spoiled me for any steak after that. While the other alums went shopping or golfing or even horse racing, Ron and I hit the road south into the Billy the Kid byway. Everyone has heard of Billy the Kid, but we were right in the area where he lived and fought. Lincoln.
Always lonely, always looking to get even with the men who did him wrong. That was Billy, lonesome Billy, who was quick to think a gun could make him strong. No one tougher or more daring, only he and his gun sharing. The great fight to live and his great love to fight. A rough man who played with danger, to whom trouble was no stranger, until one day he lay dying. He'd filled his date with destiny. Never friendly, never trusting, always kept one ready hand near his gun. That was Billy, lonesome Billy, the rough man who would rather kill than run. The rough man who would rather kill than run.
There wouldn't have been a Billy the Kid if it hadn't been for two groups of men who fought to control the resources in Lincoln that erupted as the Lincoln County War. The time was 1878-1879. Jim Dolan and his partner, John Riley, had a good thing going, a monopoly of selling beef and supplies to the Army. Enter John Henry Tunstall, a 24-year-old Brit who wanted to horn in. Alexander McSween was his lawyer and partner, and together they built a store in town, and Tunstall had a ranch outside of town. The day that Dolan's men ambushed and murdered Tunstall on his ranch was only the beginning. Both sides claimed the law. The war should have ended on the night that Dolan's men burned McSween's house down around him and killed him. But Billy the Kid and others escaped and swore to fight on. It's a fascinating story. It was a war without heroes. It captured the thought and behavior of a range of frontier personalities. It dramatized economic forces that underlay frontier conflicts. It demonstrated the intensity and varieties of frontier crime and violence. The best book I have ever read about it was High Noon in Lincoln by Robert Utley. One of the recorded books we listened to was To Hell on a Fast Horse by Mark Lee Gardner about Billy the Kid and Pat Garrett. What did Billy the Kid look like? Well, there is a tintype picture that was taken of him showing that he had buck teeth. He was 5'8" or 9". He was dead before he turned 21, so he had the brashness of youth, the energy and that feeling of invincibility that comes with youth. They talk about his dancing eyes, eyes that were always in motion, watching and assessing. He was completely unwilling to put up with anyone's shit. He was admired for his daring, his dashing, his charm by the Mexican population as well as the whites. He spoke perfect Spanish. Where a man would back down, Billy wouldn't even think about it. He'd run or pull a gun. He had a streak of ruthlessness that showed up when you pushed him to the wall. He didn't care if he had to kill you. He'd do the unexpected, like leaping to escape without any warning. You couldn't read his next move. Why didn't he just leave Lincoln, where there was a warrant for his arrest, and he was due to be hanged for the killing of Sheriff Brady. Well, he had a lot of friends in the area of Lincoln, Fort Stanton, Fort Sumter, Ruidoso, and a reputation and notoriety. In Mexico, he'd be just another gringo. He was renowned for making spectacular escapes, but his occupation was cattle rustler. He had never been wounded. Tunstall had given him a job and won his loyalty forever. Here's what a close friend had to say about Billy. Frank Coe was a regulator, one of Tunstall's soldiers. "The kid stayed with me and my home for most of one winter, during which time we became staunch friends. I never enjoyed better company. He was humorous and told many amusing stories. He always found a touch of humor in everything, being naturally full of fun and jollity. Though he was serious in emergencies, his humor was often apparent even in such situations. Billy stood with us to the end, brave and reliable, one of the best soldiers we had. He never pushed in his advice or opinions, but he had a wonderful presence of mind. The tighter the place, the more he showed his cool nerve and quick brain. He was a fine horseman, quick and always in the lead. At the same time, he was kind to his horses, and could save them and have them ready and fresh when he needed to make a dash. He never seemed to care for money, except to buy cartridges with them, and then he would prefer to gamble for them straight. Cartridges were scarce, and he always used about 10 times as many as anyone else. He would practice shooting at everything he saw and from every conceivable angle, on and off his horse. He never drank. He would go to the bar with anyone, but I never saw him drink a drop. He never used tobacco in any form. Always in a good humor and ready to do a kind act for someone." The town of Lincoln is preserved with a number of the buildings as museums. Tunstall's store is still there, along with some of its merchandise. McSween's house, which was right next door, is, of course, gone because it burnt. We had our own scare in Lincoln. The car gave us first one bell, you need to think about getting gas, and then two bells, pull over when you see a gas station, and then three bells, get gas now, stupid! One problem, no gas stations in Lincoln. We stopped briefly at Fort Stanton, which also had some fascinating stories. For instance, it was a tuberculosis hospital in the 1920s and 30s for merchant seamen. But without penicillin, the virus couldn't be cured. They have two cemeteries to prove that. And then the captain and his whole crew from the German liner Columbus were interned in 1940 to 1945. But no gas. We got back to Ruidoso and pumped in 14 gallons. What a relief. The next day, we took a trip to the west and south, to White Sands, where the sand isn't made of silica, but gypsum. It was 108 degrees, that's 42 degrees Celsius, but the sand wasn't hot. Next door is the town of Alamogordo, where Ron lived for 3 years. We found his house still being taken care of. We spent several hours, make that four, at the Space Museum. There was a lot of rockets in the yard, as well as the sled that was used for centrifugal testing. I bought a t-shirt that said, "It is rocket science." Leaving the reunion behind, we drove east to Roswell. We spent some time at the UFO Museum, which had some interesting historical pieces about the RAAF, Roswell Army Air Field, the air base there, and additional information on the rockets. That's why Ron's father was in the area, because he was installing them. Ron gleaned some information that he hadn't understood before about his dad's work. I enjoyed the historical sequencing of the incident in 1947. They even had a mock-up of the Roswell radio station. There were a lot of other areas covered which I gave a pass, like abduction by aliens. A fact you may not know. The incident in 1947, or the landing, didn't happen in Roswell, but 60 miles away, westward towards Corona. The stuff was hauled and cataloged at the nearest Air Force base, which was Roswell, before taken off to Area 51 in Nevada, to disappear forever. Here's a clip from a CD that I bought at the museum.
Headline edition, July 8, 1947. The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army. Army officers say the missile, found sometime last week, has been inspected at Roswell, New Mexico, and sent to Wright Field, Ohio, for further inspection. Headline edition will bring you special reports and interviews in a moment.
According to my dad, there was a bad thunderstorm the night before. The next day, he was out on the ranch, and he found this debris. And he picked it all up in his pickup and was talking to people. And, of course, there was some talk about UFOs. He was going to Roswell. And as far as I know, he got in touch with the sheriff's department. They, in turn, called the Air Force. Then the Air Force got with Dad and swore him to secrecy, and they came out to the ranch and picked up this debris. Wood, I call it wood, I don't know what it was. It was something like balsa wood, but it wouldn't burn, and I couldn't cut it with my knife.
We stopped in an arroyo outside of town to pick up a couple of rocks from Roswell from my friend Kim Turner. I selected ones that looked and felt distressed. Ah, but what do you think, Joy? I hear you asking. The honest truth is that I believe in possibilities. Something happened in 1947 in that town of Roswell, and I know that the government is fairly extreme about covering things up. All sorts of things. Hey, I write science fiction and read a good deal of it. As I said, I believe in possibilities. The following passage will be Ron talking about our trip to the Carlsbad Caverns.
Joy asked me to talk a little bit about Carlsbad Caverns. We went there as part of our trip. It's located in southeastern New Mexico at the edge of the Chihuahuan Desert. The cave is a big limestone cave. It was first discovered by a white person, of course, in about 1898. Jim White, who was a 16-year-old cowboy in the area, his job was fixing fences on the cattle ranches, and he saw what he thought was smoke rising. He went over and investigated and discovered that it was actually a bunch of bats coming out of the cave just after sunset. Yeah, he built some ladders to go down into it. Well, since he was repairing fences, he had wire and fence posts. So he used those to make a ladder that could actually get down into the cave. So then he used kerosene lanterns and things like that to explore it originally. So he became interested in this cave and spent the next 20 years pretty much exploring it in his own spare time. You know, tried to get people interested in seeing it, but had very little luck at all. Finally, around 1915 to 1918, he finally got a photographer to go down and took some pictures of it. The pictures were published in the New York Times in 1923, and actually that same year, the Carlsbad Caverns became a national monument. Everybody was so impressed with what it looked like. I'll explain a little bit about it. It's mainly a visual effect, of course, because you can't really touch anything because they're still considered a living cave. And living caves means that there's still water dripping down through the ceiling. And in a limestone cave, such as Carlsbad, water dripping down from the surface dissolves some of the limestone in the roof of the cave. It percolates down. When it comes out into any open chamber, part of the water evaporates, and this becomes flowstone, they call it. If it's hanging from the ceiling, it forms things that look sort of like conical ice cream cones, for instance, just hanging down from the ceiling. And if it drips down on the surface below, you get these big mounds building up, sort of looking like totem poles. Other big effects that you see there are very much like curtains. There's big billowing, waving curtains of stone that is formed over. It takes many centuries to form these things over the time. The history going way back about 250 million years ago, there was a big limestone reef formed because this area was underwater, and the corals build up this big limestone. millions of years later, this was way underwater, and oil fields that extend from eastern New Mexico into Texas, some of the oil started dripping upward from the oil fields below, and where it reached the limestone, this formed a weak sulfuric acid, and this sulfuric acid then ate out very large caverns in this big limestone reef. Millions of years later, the mountains built up in the earth, and these openings became above sea level. And when they become above sea level, then you started getting the limestone dissolved in the water that started dripping down and making the big formations in the cave. The cave is an interesting feature, being mostly visual. They give you a tour, and you can look at everything. There are handrails all on all the paths. The main chamber is 800 feet below the surface, and there is a nice mile-long, very windy little path that takes you all the way down. Or in the early 1930s, they then built an 800-foot elevator to take the tourists down into the cave so you wouldn't have to go down this steep trail. The trails within the cave, there's a self-guided tour that runs a little over an hour long. It runs about a mile. It is wheelchair accessible, and it has handrails all the way along the side. The main thing that you do is look at all these flowing structures of limestone that was deposited over the centuries. One of the big things they do in the guided tour is to sit everybody down and then turn off all the lights. The people with sight become very disoriented when it's completely black, when you have absolutely no light around you. This is something the blind people probably don't have to worry about suffering from, this disorientation. The temperature in the cave is always 56 degrees, so it's a nice, cool place inside because it's so far underground. The day we went there, it was about 106 degrees on the surface. So this is a typical summer day in New Mexico. One of the events that people tend to go and watch is the bats that come out of the cave. They're migrating bats that come up from Mexico every spring and go back down into Mexico in the fall. During the 6 months or so they're up in New Mexico, they're eating moths that are in the area and raising young bats, of course. In the evening, the bats come out of the cave and go out and do their hunting for the moths. It's a very popular event that people go there and sit around and wait for the first of the bats to come out. Normally, there's supposed to be about 500,000 bats that come out, but this year it was a very dry year and there's not many moths around. So all the other bats seem to have migrated to a different cave somewhere else where there's more water around. So there were only a few thousand bats that came out the night we were there. One of the interesting things that happened more recently, about last 20 years or so, is that there's some cave swallows that have now appeared at the caves. They weren't there before. They're swooping around collecting insects in the daylight just before dark because there's insects around in the daytime too. And all the cave swallows then vanish at sunset and then the bats come out. If you take the walking tour that goes down into the cave, they go by the what's called the Bat Cave, which is an area off to the side. People aren't allowed into that area with the bats. And the major part of the cave that's toured by the tourists is so far away from the entrance that there's never any bats there, so you never have to worry about bats flying around. In the 1970s, the Parks Department hired a lighting director from Broadway to come in and redo the electric lights that light up the caves. They designed them so that the lights are shining on the flowstone formations in the cave rather than just having lights around the paths where people walk. This indirect lighting is enough that the paths are easy to see, but it makes a much more interesting, dramatic effect for people who are seeing it. The month before we got to the cave, there was a prairie fire that went by and actually closed the cave for a couple days. It burnt some of the cactus that are around there. Didn't quite get to the buildings that had the tourist areas above the cave, but it was a concern. They had another one about a year earlier that came into the area. There's no trees at all in that whole area. There's little bushes and mostly cactus, a very dry area. There are two types of tours that are offered in the cave. There's a self-guided tour that walks through what's called the big room. And there's another tour that you can sign up for and pay a couple dollars to get on, and it's guided by a ranger. We started at about 11 o'clock because we did the guided tour first. And the self-guided tour, we were wandering around this big room. It's a mile-long circular path. And we were about the only people walking on it. And it felt a little bit spooky being nobody else around for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of yards around you as you're walking through this very quiet cave. There's lots of formations as you circle around. Parts of the cave have no stalactites and stalagmites, which are the flowstone, because if the ceiling isn't porous, there's nothing falls down, and you just have this fallen rocks that have come down over the millions of years. The parts that have the flowstone on them, sometimes you can see the formations are tilted, which means that the rocks they're attached to have fallen since the formations of flowstone happened. I don't know if they would actually let you touch something or not, because they don't want people touching any of the rock there, because if you get the oil from your fingers on the limestone, then the dripping water will no longer stick properly, so that will prevent it from growing anymore.
Following our trip to the Carlsbad Caverns, we headed north to the old, old town of Santa Fe. It's a town we've heard of and never seen. It's the oldest town in America, and it's at the end of the El Camino Real, the road from Mexico City. There is a Santa Fe style, which grew out of Edgar Hewitt's desire to restore the Palace of the Governors to an authentic style. The Palace of the Governors has been the governing house in Santa Fe since the 1600s until 1915. The style is Spanish Pueblo Mission Revival. The buildings are very square, usually one-storied, with the timbers that support the roof visible under the ceiling of the room. The color of the walls mimic the colors of the earth, mostly a soft orange. The buildings were always built of whatever was at hand, which ended up being adobe brick, then covered with a layer of mud. And this look is everywhere, and is probably mandatory if you build anything.
Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Be the first one to fire. Every man is a liar. There's just one kind of man who tells the truth. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Don't be a fool for a smile or a kiss, or your bullet might miss. Keep your eye on your goal. There's just one rule that can save you your life. It's a hand on your knife and the devil in your soul. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Or a gringo like me. Or a gringo like me. Like me.
Something else I didn't know. Santa Fe started in 1607, and of course the missionaries came to save souls of the Indians. But the Spanish settlers could collect tribute, goods, or services from the Indians in return for protection from Comanche raids. By 1670, the abuses of the system and the resentment over the attempts to suppress Pueblo dances and ceremonies couldn't be contained. In 1675, 47 Pueblo priests were arrested and 4 were hung. The others were whipped or flogged. So, 5 years later, in 1680, there was a leader, Pope, from the San Juan Pueblo, who organized a revolt. He sent out knotted ropes to every Pueblo with the word to open one knot a day. If all the knots were gone, it was the day to attack, because he wanted every Pueblo to attack at once. That was August 10. Their main goal were the missions. Destroy the bells, kill the priests, destroy the religious objects, kill the Spanish, man, woman, child. The survivors fled to Santa Fe, and 11 days later, a total withdrawal was ordered. Only a third of the population, all that was left of 3,000, headed south. The Spanish didn't come back until 1692, when the Indian coalition had weakened. And of course, it was a reconquest with retribution levied out on the Indians. Santa Fe contains 4 historic districts and some 3,500 listed buildings, some dating back to the 1700s. They use all of the old buildings. There's an area called Canyon where artists in the 1930s had cheap housing. Well, now every house is a gallery. Every other shop downtown is either a gallery or a museum. You've heard of Willa Cather and her book, Death Comes for the Archbishop? It was written in Santa Fe and was based on the life of Jean-Baptiste Lamy, who spent the latter half of his life in Santa Fe, shepherding the Catholics and fighting for his St. Francis Cathedral. He died in 1888. We walked around the cathedral. At one edge of it is the statue La Conquistadora, the statue of Mary. During the 1680 Pueblo Revolt, she was saved in a last-ditch effort by a priest who carried her in his arms as he fled from the Indians. In 1692, she returned in triumph. She leaves the church periodically for festival parades. She has over 200 changes of costumes and wigs. We took a day trip to Taos, the site of many a rendezvous with the mountain men in the 1800s. Now, like Santa Fe, it is full of artists and galleries. One fascinating museum we visited was Millicent Rogers Museum. She was the granddaughter of one of the founders of Standard Oil and had had rheumatic fever when she was 8. So she was frequently ill, but she was very much a fashion plate. She came to Taos in 1947 after she'd had her heart broken by Clark Gable. She fell in love with the area, the art, and the Indian way of life. She adopted the Navajo style of clothing and had all sorts of silver buttons to accessorize her velvet blouses. She amassed an extraordinary collection of silver, turquoise, coral, inlaid shell Indian jewelry, Pueblo pottery, weavings, blankets, Apache baskets. She died after 5 short years, but she left behind a letter to her son, which is part of the museum. The years in Taos, for her, were unblemished beauty, and she wasn't afraid to die. Dear Polly, did I ever tell you about the feeling that I had a while ago? Suddenly passing Taos Mountain, I felt that I was part of the earth, so that I felt the sun on my surface and the rain. I felt the stars and the growth of the moon. Under me, rivers ran. We drove up to and walked over the bridge that spans the Rio Grande Gorge. In 1964, it was called the Bridge to Nowhere because the road didn't continue on the other side. We observed a pod or a clutch of earthships, homes built into the ground designed to be off the grid. They had one wall of windows facing the sun and other walls made out of bottles imprisoned in concrete. The structural walls were made of rammed tires, where one man shoveled dirt into a tire and the other man slams it with a sledgehammer. When completed, they weigh 300 pounds. And yeah, the Earthship colony began in the early 70s, and you can guess it was probably the hippies. Further down the road was the affordable building sites, each with a school bus to live in. Leaving the Taos Santa Fe area, we drove west into Arizona and then into California, sometimes on parts of Route 66. We stopped at the Painted Desert with its various shades of sand and the petrified forest. I'm from a forest country, and it was eerie looking at a log laying on its side and feel that it was stone. The wood had been displaced by minerals over the course of time. Also on the Route 66 was we turned around a corner, and there was the trailer park that they used in The Last Starfighter. Unfortunately, I didn't have the presence of mind to have Ron stop and take a picture of it. Had to take a picture of the motel that is made up of teepees, and in front of each teepee was a 1950 car. And sometimes you had the modern cars parked alongside. It was a really good visual. In California, we had a quick visit with Ivan Curry and stayed overnight with Barbara Fuller. We celebrated her 90th birthday on July 31. Then north to Santa Rosa and Petaluma to spend 3 days with my friends Mary and Gus. And then over the hump to Oroville to stay a couple of days with Barb and Jerry Williams. We would have stopped to see Esther McVeigh in Eugene, Oregon, except she had fallen and broken a couple of bones at her daughter's, so she wasn't home. Well, that's a glimmer of our longest vacation ever. 5,000 miles and 18 tanks of gas. Wow.